Greetings, Indigenous Earthlings. Here we are again, balancing into another Express Yourself on a sunny summer afternoon in the Roaring Fork Valley. I'm Luke Nestler. Back in the oldest days, when we were all hairy and all the same color, we came down out of the trees when it was safe, and we told stories to each other that we believed. Eventually, we came to believe that heaven was on the earth, and since she was the source of all life, along with light from the sun, that is what we venerated and celebrated, and we considered her worthy to be loved as a child, praised and protected unto the seventh generation. And we recognized any belief otherwise as what it was, a toxic need to control and dictate and accumulate. In the long run, the bald heads will never win, nor the Jamaican prophet be forgotten. Time will tell. Think you're in heaven, but you're living in hell. And so for this 4th of July, I want to celebrate the things that make us all alike. Our common human mammal lives on a planet which, miraculously, still sustains us. We are indeed all Indigenous Earthlings. Try to remember the common root of our humanity and water it with attention and care. Try to remember the things we all love, red or blue, our families, our musics, our foods, our stories. The stories are all different, but the need to tell them remains the same for all of us. This too shall pass, but let's not hurry to get there. Let's savor the moments we share together, hard as they may be at first. Let's do it right from the beginning, shall we? We must forgive. We must not forget. And so today's Express Yourself features a look at two Americans who also lived in troubled times, the 1930s, Will Rogers and Marian Anderson. In 1939, the Daughters of the American Revolution refused to allow global opera superstar and black woman from Philadelphia, Marian Anderson, to perform in Independence Hall in Washington, D.C., because of the color of her skin. Eleanor Roosevelt and her husband, the president, saw to it that she performed a free concert on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, attended by 75,000 people. So give a listen to her story, courtesy of the Smithsonian Institution.
Welcome to Portraits, a podcast from the Smithsonian National Portrait Gallery, where art and biography, history and identity collide. I'm Kim Sayet. Today, we're talking about a woman who helped to pave the way for the civil rights movement. It was not a role that she had asked for, rather one that she assumed by drawing a deep breath, closing her eyes, and singing. I'm talking about the classical singer featured in our exhibition, One Life, Marian Anderson. Anderson broke all kinds of barriers. For example, she was the first African-American to perform at the Metropolitan Opera in 1955. But she's best known for a concert she gave in 1939. At the time, Jim Crow laws were in full force in the South, and even though Anderson was critically acclaimed all over Europe, she still faced discrimination at home. The Daughters of the American Revolution refused to let her sing in their Constitution Hall. This, needless to say, sparked a huge controversy, and eventually the government arranged for Anderson to sing at an even bigger venue, the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. It was Easter Sunday, and 75,000 people showed up in solidarity to listen.
Genius draws no color line. And so it is fitting that Marian Anderson should raise her voice in tribute to the noble Lincoln whom mankind will ever honor.
As we were thinking about this exhibition, I realized with a bit of shock that a lot of people haven't actually heard of Marian Anderson, even though she was super famous.
There's this thing called Marian Fever that's taking place.
Marian Fever?
Yes, so the press coined Marian Fever because she was so popular that she started doing these concerts and people just wanted to go see her perform.
That's Leslie Ureña from the Department of Photographs here at the National Portrait Gallery. She curated our exhibition on Marian Anderson.
Everyone talks about how listening to her was just overwhelming, that she really could capture the nature of the songs in a way that really made people feel them and even cry.
So who was this reserved woman at the center of the storm? And how did she make history as both a performer and a civil rights icon? Before we sat down in the studio, I met with Leslie at the exhibition to talk about all of this and more. So, Leslie, this is so much fun because you and I don't often have time together that is outside of big meetings about exhibitions and research. And we have the gallery to ourselves. I never realized there was an echo in this gallery.
There's an echo. It's great. This is my favorite part of the day, actually, to kind of come in here just to myself and talk to myself even into the artwork.
It's one of the privileges of working here. And I often, when I really want to run away, I go where no one actually would think to find you, which is in the museum. So where do you want to start? Like, tell me, when we start the story of Marian Anderson, what is the most interesting moment where suddenly she's going to become this incredible woman who changes America?
Well, part of it is actually going back to Philadelphia, to where she was born and where she received her early musical training. And when I started looking at her training in Philadelphia, I realized that her story expands into segregation beyond the DAR Constitution Hall incident, but also segregation throughout her life, whether it was not being able to train with certain vocal teachers in Philadelphia, whether she was traveling on segregated trains, and even when she goes to Europe, where although she's welcome there, she does start encountering the rise of the Nazis, and that starts affecting her concert tours.
One of the pictures that I love is actually belongs to the special collections at the University of Pennsylvania, which of course is based in Philadelphia. And it's Marian as a soloist for the Clef Club at the Academy of Music. And she is standing in front of this giant bouquet of flowers that is almost as tall as she is. It's just an extraordinary, she's so young, she's incredibly beautiful. Can you tell me a little bit about this picture? I mean, it was extraordinary for any young woman to be having this kind of a picture and these flowers sent to her. Who sent her these flowers? What was this occasion?
Well, I'm glad that you brought up the flowers because her mother especially writes or spoke about how she herself was completely overwhelmed when this huge bouquet came on the stage at the end of this concert. So by 1918, when this photograph was made, Anderson had already been performing at her local church and at different churches throughout Philadelphia, in fact, and had become the baby contralto and had really been very popular by this point. But popular to a certain degree. So by 1918, she's performing with this orchestra that comes in from New York, and she's a soloist for their concert. So the community gets involved in making her dress, sewing rosebuds to it, and also in obtaining and buying this enormous bouquet for her to congratulate her at the end of the concert. So it's really one of the concerts that puts her on a bigger stage, more or less, and makes her more visible beyond a local audience.
So in fact, you can listen to her at our kiosk. Shall we play it? So I love this.
Easter demonstration. 75,000 mass before Lincoln Memorial.
There are two, actually, that I really, really enjoy. One of them is Anderson at Home, where you see her at her farm in Connecticut.
Here among the rolling hills, the trees, and the land she loves deeply, She rests between the strenuous seven-month tours.
So this introduction to Anderson, the other Anderson, the Anderson at home, the homemaker, the amateur photographer, the good cook.
The satisfying small activities of rural living, weeding the vegetable patch or sewing the new curtains for spring. And finally, all too soon, the moment when Mariana becomes a place of serious work as another tour is scheduled to begin.
So, Leslie, as a curator, as you know, you go through this very strange moment where you really get to know the person that you're researching very, very well. Were there parts of Marian Anderson's private life or just things that you found out later that really surprised you?
Well, yes, there were. Because I had access to their to her archive at UPenn, that was really remarkable. So I had letters, I had her receipts from the farm, I had recipes, so I didn't know she
recipes. Yes. Really?
So
like what
pancakes,
did she like to cook?
Which included shortening, so I have not tried it.
Shortening and pancakes.
Yes, okay. 6 tablespoons worth. Yes, I
no
don't
wonder
know.
They were delicious.
No wonder, I'm sure they were. So getting to see that aspect of her was great, and even learning that she sometimes traveled with her sewing machine so that she could entertain herself while she was on the road, and that she made curtains for her farm. I mean, as when you go into these things, you don't think of Marian Anderson. She sang at the Metropolitan Opera on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, and she sewed curtains.
That's really incredible.
Yeah, so it's the other side, yeah. Like the human side.
Yeah, the human side.
Right, but,
yeah.
You know, she also was an amateur photographer, and she had a dark room in her at her farm.
Did she really?
Right, and there are a lot of the pictures in the archive were actually taken by her.
So Leslie, talking about private lives and things that we actually don't know about Marian Anderson, there's a more complicated story about her background. Can you explain?
Yes. So as discussed in one of her biographies very briefly, she was also part Native American from her dad's side. So it was her grandmother from her father's side.
Interesting.
And it's something that doesn't come out in any of the other, you know, in her own papers. It's not really mentioned.
I had never knew about it until you said something.
Right. So it's really something that, you know, we mentioned it briefly in the exhibition, but it's really something that's fascinating just to figure out why is it not mentioned more.
And it's from her grandmother's side?
From her grandmother's side and her dad's side.
Okay. But just as you said, these sort of these very public individuals who have these very private lives, and then you later on learn so much more about them. So one of the sheroes that we have, certainly I have personally, is Eleanor Roosevelt, and she plays a pretty critical role in Marian Anderson's life. But interestingly, she felt compelled to sort of point out to the First Lady, don't put me in a box, right? Don't stereotype who I am because of my race or my gender. You know, I am my own person. Can you go into that a little bit more?
Right, so Marian Anderson was invited by Eleanor Roosevelt to perform at the White House in 1936. And when she was asked, it was suggested to her that she perform spirituals. And a lot of what Anderson was an expert in singing from a very early age, they were spirituals. But these are also tied to a particular race, so
genre.
Right. So she did respectfully push back and say, you know, I also would like to sing part of my classical repertoire. So it was not necessarily expected of her and certainly not believed that she could even do it. And part of the criticism sometimes was, oh, can she sing these or not? But she trained in them, and that's what part of the reason she goes to Europe to train.
We're going to take a break here. And when we come back, more on that history-making moment when Marian Anderson performed on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in 1939. That was 24 years before Martin Luther King Jr. made his I Have a Dream speech in the very same spot. Stay with us. Hello, podcast listeners. We have a great online event coming up that revisits the most controversial exhibition the National Portrait Gallery has ever created. One that set the art world on fire and became a cause célèbre for the freedom of speech and First Amendment rights. It was called Hide Seek, Difference and Desire in American Portraiture. And when it opened 10 years ago, it was the first attempt by a major national museum to visualize LGBTQ identity in portraiture. It was an opportunity to acknowledge how artists reflected more fluid attitudes towards sexuality, desire, and romantic attachment. You might remember that it became a major touchstone in the culture wars around censorship. Hosted on Zoom on Tuesday, June the 23rd at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, the gallery's senior historian, Gwendolyn Dubois-Shaw, will talk about what happened, and she'll be joined by the curators of the exhibition, Jonathan Katz and David Ward. You can register for this free event in the calendar at our website, npg.si.edu, or on our National Portrait Gallery Facebook page. This program is part of the Tommy L. Pegus and Donald A. Kaposha Conversation Series on LGBTQ Identity and Portraiture. It's a new initiative offered by Portal, the Gallery Centre for Scholarship. Remember, Tuesday, June the 23rd at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll see you there. I'm Kim Siet, your host on Portraits, and I'm talking with curator Leslie Ureña about the elegant contralto Marian Anderson. Because of her race, Anderson was famously barred from performing at Constitution Hall by the Daughters of the American Revolution. This outraged First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt. She not only resigned her membership from the group, she intervened to secure a new venue, and what a venue it was. The Lincoln Memorial. That open-air concert would go down in the history books as a landmark moment in the struggle for civil rights. Let's get back to the gallery. So let's look at the iconic picture that I think most people know. Here she is standing on the Lincoln Memorial steps. Can you describe what's happening here in this particular photograph that was taken by Robert Scurlock in 1939.
Right, so Robert Scurlock is part of the Scurlock Studio here that was based here in Washington, D.C. He was an African-American photographer, and he and his father and brothers were sort of where African-Americans went to get their pictures taken. And what we see here is Anderson in profile facing the crowd, with the piano to her behind her and a bank of microphones in front of her. And her eyes are actually closed. She has to almost close her eyes and to sort of get rid of the crowd, even though it's this vast expanse that's before her. It's really, you see her with her mouth slightly open, just about to, you know, belt out whatever song it is that she's performing at this point. So it's fairly close-up picture, so you really see the intensity of the moment for Anderson herself.
You see her singing, and right behind her is that giant sculpture mm-hmm. of Abraham Lincoln. Right. And so here is literally the man who emancipated the slaves, and you have her, you know, still fighting discrimination. And then you see this crowd, which is, there is not a square piece of land, you know, in front of her. Everybody is mesmerized by it.
Right, and the crowd, I mean, it's amazing. You see it go all the way to the Washington Monument when you see the picture of what she would have seen.
75,000 mass before Lincoln Memorial to hear Marian Anderson, colored contralto, make her capital debut at the Great Emancipator Shrine.
And I have read that she was incredibly nervous, right? She did not want this kind of attention. So whether it's out of nerves or whether it's very deliberate, Marian Anderson changes the third line in the opening song of America from singular to plural. So she actually says, "My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee we sing." So she makes it "we sing," not "I sing." And that is a huge symbolic gesture. So the joke is really on them at the end of the day, because instead of fitting what maybe 4,000 people into a hall, they have 75,000 people lined up along the reflecting pool in front of the steps, and it's then broadcast to millions more. I mean, you know, it would have been a concert and probably everybody would have at some point forgotten about it, but now it has become this key moment in our history. So this
So this photograph is actually in our collection, and I love this as well. Can you describe it, Leslie?
Yes, so what we have is Marian Anderson. It's a photograph from 1947 where she is at a rehearsal with Leonard Bernstein. So they are both on the stage at Lewisohn Stadium in New York City, and the stadium is no longer there, but Lewisohn Stadium had a very relevant, a very important role in Anderson's life, because in 1925, she was entered into a contest by her voice teacher, and he didn't tell her that he had entered her, and she goes ahead and beats out 300 plus other contestants. So there are multiple rounds of auditions, and the field keeps on getting smaller, but by the end, when there are only 7 people left, the judges decide just to give it to her. So she...
No contest.
No contest there.
Let's just save ourselves some time and just give her...
Give it to her. Why are we all here? And in 1925, this August 25 concert really puts her in New York, where...
It
all begins in a way, right?
But with Leonard Bernstein.
With Leonard Bernstein, who's made his New York debut and is this sensation.
So what's really interesting about this photograph is it's almost like a split screen, because you have right in the middle the microphone stand that reads visually like a line. And on the left-hand side is Marian Anderson singing into the microphone. And on the right-hand side, you have Leonard Bernstein, who's conducting with his hands literally up in the air. But he's looking across to her. And I guess he's very aware of her, she's very aware of him.
Well, the two of them had, and their body language really evokes the good professional relationship that they had. They really have to be in sync. And the two of them are obviously in sync in this photograph. You know, she's facing away looking at the microphone, but he's looking to her to see, you know, where is she going? How am I going to conduct the orchestra behind her?
I'm still pretty surprised, actually, in this year, the anniversary of her singing on the Lincoln Memorial steps, 80 years since 1939, that there isn't more discussion about her. And interestingly, there are still a lot of people who really have no idea who she is. Why is that?
It's funny because I talk to friends about the show and they're like, who's Marian Anderson? So I've also gotten
really?
That friend to
Are
tell
you,
me that.
Do you disfriend them? Do you say, I'm upset with you?
How dare you not know who she is? No.
Yes.
No, but, you know, she is in a lot of history books. It's just that it might be in some of the history books, it might be a blip, you know, the way that we're taught history, sometimes some moments are more memorable than others, especially in high school. But one part I think is the feel that the classical music, maybe that because she was in classical music, maybe there was something about that was doesn't stick.
Because classical music itself seems like such a club that people maybe either that's are part of or they're not.
Or they're not, even though she was incredibly popular, even though, you know, 75,000 people showed up on the Mall, that there might be something to that effect that, you know, she is performing at Carnegie Hall, but who has money to go to Carnegie Hall?
Because it's elitist, maybe? I mean, it's a little bit different from Rosa Parks is on the back of the bus,
right? She's on the back of the bus. And also the idea that, you know, with Rosa Parks, it's that moment that it was a breaking point.
Right, she ignites a whole movement.
Right, and even though Rosa Parks was also part of a larger movement, there's something, but I think there's a distance that one has, at least I perceive, in terms of classical music versus more popular forms, maybe. Or even a moment like the bus. Everyone takes the bus.
So as often happens with people who come into the portrait gallery, as I often say, it's not what you look like that matters. It's what you do. But it's also how you've changed history in the moment in which you are living, whether you like it or not. And Marian Anderson broke all sorts of ceilings. She wanted to sing. She wanted to use her voice to the best of her ability. To what extent, Leslie, did she identify with the civil rights movement and become an active instrument for change? Or was it something that she reluctantly took on?
I perceive it as being she was a reluctant icon. And part of what drew me to her as a figure was this tension of someone who was a symbol and how do you work through being a symbol of a movement and at the same time not feel extremely comfortable talking about it in public. I know that she held views that were definitely in line with the civil rights movement, and she was at the March on Washington, but she wasn't out there in a very active way. It was more by the work that she did. There were barriers in Philadelphia that she broke, then in Europe, and then in the United States, and that each of these stages that she performs on is actually a step in that direction. And as of 39, she really becomes a symbol because of the magnitude of that concert and all that the controversy around it. But she doesn't seem that comfortable, and she talks about it in a very modest way. She talks about opening doors for others, but if others didn't have it in them, it wouldn't happen. So,
right. I mean, if you're going to go into politics, this is why you're going, right? This is to announce change. Mm-hmm. But she wanted to sing.
She wanted to sing.
She wanted to entertain and bring pleasure to people. And this whole other part of this role that she found herself in was something that she had to juggle.
Right. The art of singing is really what she wanted to be at the forefront, and that shows ways of moving forward.
In his hands he's got you and me, sister. In his hands he's got you and me, brother. In his hands he's got the whole world in his hands.
A big thank you to Leslie for taking us around the exhibition One Life, Marian Anderson. There are so many paintings and photographs and memorabilia in this exhibition that we just didn't have enough time to talk about them today. But if you're in the neighbourhood, please come by and see them all for yourselves here at the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C. The exhibition is open until May the 17th of 2020. You can also see the images that we talked about on our website at npg.si.edu/podcasts. And thanks also to the UCLA Film and Television Archive and Critical Past for their archival footage. Our podcast team includes Ruth Morris, Jason Orfanon, Deborah Sism, and Rebecca Casemeyer. Our theme music is by Joe Kai. Tarek Fuda is our engineer. Until next time, I'm Kim Sayet.
That's our text, Tax Dollars at Work. Stay with me, American humorist Will Rogers coming right up. But first, the most heartfelt version of this song ever recorded. Ray Charles may have been blind, but he saw the light.
Brotherhood from sea to sea.
Happy 4th of July, everybody. Will Rogers was a red dirt Okie and a silent film cowboy star. During the Depression, he was known as our nation's premier humorist, and he gave a desperate country reason to laugh. He once said, "There's no trick to being a humorist when you have the whole government working for you." He also said, "America has the best politicians money can buy." Well, the more things change, the more they stay the same, I guess. Anyway, here's a quick listen in on a remarkable American life, courtesy, again, of the Smithsonian Institution.
Hello, podcast listeners. It's Kim Sayet here. A quick programming note. Like most of you, we've been scrambling to adjust to the challenges of stopping the spread of the coronavirus, so we've switched up a few things. This season will include several episodes that we've been laboring away on since before the pandemic upended our routines. But we're also shuffling in three episodes meant to ease the strain of social distancing. We've asked some of our curators and educators to point to one of their favourite portraits in the gallery, and we'll take you to stand right in front of it. These will be little virtual tours, if you like, where you can hear the story behind the image and the reason why our curators love them so much. So gather with us and come and visit with your ears. Here's our first episode, which we started before COVID-19 entered our lives. It's about someone who helped the United States through another really difficult time, the Great Depression, and he did so with humor and civility. Stay well, stay tuned, and please stay healthy. Welcome to Portraits, a podcast from the Smithsonian National Portrait Gallery, where art and biography, history and identity collide. I'm Kim Sayet. The political moment that we're currently in feels like a particularly charged time of partisanship and verbal sniping. But if all the animosity and name-calling have gotten too loud, allow me to reintroduce you to the life and humour of Hollywood legend Will Rogers.
The most unemployed, the hungriest man in America, has contributed in some way to the wealth of every millionaire in America.
He may be new to you, but those of us who knew him best remember Rogers as the cowboy philosopher with the big smile who could lasso anything and make anybody laugh. But he was also a shrewd political commentator who managed to tackle controversial topics and leave no one offended. He lambasted politicians and bankers and gangsters, but his earthy humour always managed to remove the sting. It was Will Rogers who said he never met a man he didn't like. So let me take you back to the 1920s. It was the advent of frozen food. Jazz was taking off and Babe Ruth ruled baseball. It was a time of great wealth, but also huge economic disparities. The Ku Klux Klan was growing and the Great Depression was just around the corner. Alcohol was illegal, and Will Rogers was one of the most famous people in the United States.
He once said, "It's great to be great, but it's greater to be human." That really underscores Will Rogers' humility and his outlook on life.
That's Jim Barber, a historian here at the gallery and the curator of our upcoming exhibition, One Life, Will Rogers. I asked Jim to sit down with me and paint a picture of this cowboy, comedian, newspaper columnist, movie star. We started not with a man, but with the teenager. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Kim.
I'm going to start with this amazing picture of a young man who is a military school cadet of circa 1897 is the date of this photograph. And I would love you to describe what this portrait looks like. I would never in a million years looking at this portrait have thought where his life and his career would lead him.
Well, he didn't think so either. He is in a cadet uniform, the uniform of the Kemper Military School in Boonville, Missouri. And he's all dressed up here. It looks like he just, you know, had a bath and clean clothes. Well, this was atypical. He's going to be a cowboy, as we'll learn later. So he wasn't in his element physically, although this is a very nice image of him, hair combed and all. And he really was not in his element intellectually. Will liked the open range. His father was a large rancher, had many cattle. The education classroom, school classroom, never really was a good fit for Will.
And this is Will Rogers. But he's not a great student. But what he does do is he practices all the time with this lariat, with this lasso, and he's lassoing everything. I have this vision of this young boy basically lassoing the dogs and the chickens and the farm posts. And he got really good, right? So good that he ends up on stage.
And he was good to the point where he could use three ropes and he could lasso a horse and the rider with three ropes.
No kidding.
Now, keep in mind, cowboy for Will Rogers was not the Tom Mix gun-toting cowboy or the Roy Rogers or, you know, you name it, or Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Will Rogers never carried a gun.
Interesting.
I don't even know whether he owned a gun. But his weapon of choice, if you will, was the lasso, and he could do just about anything with that.
Jim, Will Rogers was also known for his wanderlust, right?
Well, he had wanderlust from an early age, and when he left school, he did not have a diploma. He made his father a little unhappy. Will knew that he really couldn't stay at home, and he didn't want to stay at home. So he was taken with these Western acts, roping acts and circuses, and he goes to South Africa when he's in his late teens.
Wow.
And he gets a job roping with Texas Jack's Wild West Circus.
So this is the idea that sort of the American vaudeville is coming to South Africa. They're doing the world tour, so to speak?
Right, exactly. And so he really has no money, but he manages to get to South Africa, and he earns a little money. And this is the beginning of his, I think he circled the globe with many stops in between twice in his life. And travel would be something that would just be part of his life.
But he also has a sort of an interesting heritage in that he is a quarter Cherokee. He's Native American as well. Is this something that he embraced fully in his life, or was it something that was not talked about as much? Did he think about himself as a sort of a pioneer of Native Americans?
Well, he was born on Indian land owned by the Cherokees, and that's where the ranch was. So Will Rogers grew up with this Cherokee heritage, which he was very proud of, and he used to joke, he had a favorite joke that he would say. He said, my ancestors didn't come over on the Mayflower. They met the boat.
Sort of very tongue-in-cheek, but also in its own way very profound, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Jim, Will Rogers rises to fame. He gets his start in show business, and there's this fabulous picture. I love this photograph that's in the exhibition that you're doing called Will Rogers Roping the Cast at the Ziegfeld Follies. And it's like this pyramid of actresses, I guess dancers from the Follies. And he's right at the top of that pyramid, but they're all wearing hats and they're all sort of have this kind of faux showbiz Western gear on. The picture's a little bit blurred of him at the top. It looks like he must have been gesturing, and therefore you get this blurry image in the photograph.
And that's because he's swinging a lasso.
Oh, yes.
In this image, there are, I don't know, maybe 20 women, and they're stacked in a pyramid, like, and Will is at the top, and he has a lasso. And at the bottom, you can see that's where the large loop is that's going around, and it's going around
so
and around.
So he's lassoing around this pyramid,
yes,
of women. How does he get from cowboy to the stage?
That is by way of his wife. It was a suggestion when he was doing his roping acts for the Ziegfeld Follies that his wife, Betty, suggested, maybe you might want to explain what you're doing. And Will tried that, and it worked. And he worked in jokes. If he missed a trick, he had a joke that, he would use. But he also loved the newspapers, and he kept abreast of local news, and he realized that there was an opportunity to do commentary on current events, the day's news.
Well, let's face it. I mean, a lot of what happens in politics is kind of funny. And he had this one quote, "Congress is so strange. A man gets up to speak and says nothing. Nobody listens. And then everybody disagrees."
Right. Well, Congress was one of his favorite targets to jab at.
Sort of the Steve Colbert of his day, I guess.
Absolutely. And he once said that, he didn't make jokes. He just watched Congress and reported the facts.
This is really salient for what we've all been going through recently. He said, "About all I can say about the U.S. Senate is that it opens with a prayer and closes with an investigation." So not much has changed. Not
exactly. That's part of Will Rogers' relevance today.
You know, it's interesting that in our research, we found some of his biographers actually amending his quotes. In one case, there was a little bit of an off-color discussion about bankers as Shylocks, which, as we know now, is a denigrating word for people of Jewish descent. I think that it'd be true to say that Will Rogers was not racist, but rather was sort of using the terminology of his time. But what is interesting is how later on historians sort of amended that record, and we've had to go back and sort of put it in the context of its moment.
Well, good historians would not have amended that. And good historians don't make judgments. And it's amazing that, when all was said and done, he was so well liked by all segments of society. And a lot of that had to do with, he was non-judgmental. He didn't make distinctions, and he was just very accepting of everyone. And the famous Will Rogers quote that people probably know best is, "I never met a man I didn't like."
When we come back, the cowboy with the lasso sharpens his wit and rises to even greater fame. He paves the way for Bob Hope and shares the silver screen with the likes of Mickey Rooney. Stay with us. Hey everyone, many of you like me are staying at home to help stop the spread of the coronavirus and using this unexpected gift of time to learn something new. You might think of exploring your inner imagination. And one way to start this is to watch the National Portrait Gallery's Open Studio with artist Jill Galloway. It's available in the video section of our Facebook page at Smithsonian NPG every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's when Jill posts a new lesson using simple materials that you have lying around, like pencil and paper. I really love the advice that Jill gives in her first lesson on blind contouring. You don't have to have any great skill. It's not supposed to be beautiful art. It is practice art. So practice away while no one's watching, and please take care of yourself and those around you. talking about Will Rogers with the National Portrait Gallery's historian and curator, Jim Barber. In his day, Rogers was as famous as George Clooney, as stinging in his political commentary as, say, Stephen Colbert, and as well-liked as the children's television personality, Mr. Rogers. He made more than 70 movies, most of them silent. But this humble cowboy found his voice as a social commentator and celebrity speaker.
There's not a product that you can name that we haven't got more of it than any country ever had in the face of the earth. And yet we've got people starving. We'll hold the distinction of being the only nation in the history of the world that ever went to the poorhouse in an automobile.
He penned more than 3,600 newspaper columns, often taking aim at politicians. He once famously quipped, "America has the best politicians that money can buy." Let's get back to our conversation. So I understand it that Rogers really saw himself as sort of everyman's man. He really looked out for the less successful in terms of wealth and position in our communities. Is that true?
Absolutely. He made tons of money, and this was during the Depression. When I say tons of money, I'm talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars. He made more money than Babe Ruth did.
And, no kidding.
And Babe Ruth made a lot of money. But Rogers, he gave tens of thousands of dollars away to charities, charities like the Red Cross, Salvation Army. Will Rogers was a genuine philanthropist, and he understood what people were going through in the Depression.
At least 7 million people are out of work. That's our only problem. There is no other one before us at all.
Part of his famous radio interview of about 1931, he would say that with Prohibition, or the end of Prohibition, he was saying, you know, the country is so worried about Americans not having a drink. Well, what about Americans not having anything to eat?
Your neighbor's children that are hungry. It's food. It ain't drink that we're worried about today. Here a few years ago, we were so afraid that the poor people would liable to take a drink that now we've fixed so they can't even get something to eat. Here we are in a country with more wheat and more corn.
And he put things in a perspective that all Americans could understand.
Could identify mm-hmm. with, yeah. You also have this really interesting picture of him typing into a Remington. It looks like a portable one, as much as that's it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about laptops these days, you can see how still for portable, it's quite bulky. Where is he?
Well, likely he's at Fox Studios in Hollywood.
But he's in a car.
He is in a automobile. Now, he was given a trailer home. And Fox did this wonderful, very plush accommodations for him. It's an enlarged dressing room, if you will. But he didn't want anything to do with that.
Oh, he didn't
so
want
he
to?
So he had a daily column called Will Rogers Says, and he also had a weekly column that was a little longer. And this picture is of Will Rogers at a portable typewriter sitting in his car. It's probably a Ford because Henry Ford gave him the first Model A.
No kidding.
Yes, as a gift. But anyway, he's typing out one of his columns. He could work anywhere, but he would talk about in his columns anything of interest that Americans were thinking about, whether it be where's the next paycheck coming from during the Depression or the baseball, taxes, Congress. There was just a whole medley of topics that he would address of interest.
You know, to that point, here's this wonderful quote that he made when, I'll just read it and you can see what the moment was in history. He said, "Another American woman just swam the English Channel. Her husband was carried from the boat, suffering from cold and exposure. Yours for revised edition of the dictionary explaining which is the weaker sex." He had this great way of turning things on their head.
Yes.
I mean, just to maintain that, a column every day, you're in studios, you're on radio. He must have had a huge amount of energy.
Well, he did, and that's evidenced by his wanderlust. This man could not sit still. I mean, he, as they say, he had sand in his shoes, and he was always on the move. This is the man that, you know, from China, he went to Korea, Russia. He was a tremendous aviation buff.
And so he would fly from place to place.
He would fly. He would, you know, take these barn-burning planes, these small biplanes, and he would. That's what he would use. He was cautioned, however, by Charles Lindbergh. And Lindbergh, of course,
the
famous aviator that made the first nonstop trip across the Atlantic. Lindbergh cautioned him. He said, you really ought to just stick to commercial aviation. And, well, in this day, commercial aviation, the airlines, they only flew to the largest cities. And Will Rogers was going a lot of places these planes didn't fly. So he wanted none of that. Must have drove his wife a little
crazy.
And and the one place at the towards the end of his life he had not been to was Alaska. And he had always wanted to see it. Alaska is still the great, you know, pristine wilderness.
So let's talk about this last picture that shows Will Rogers and Wiley Post planning their trip to Alaska in 1935. Can you describe this portrait?
This portrait, it's a photograph, and it's of Will Rogers is standing on a single-wing plane, and the plane is owned by Wiley Post. Now, Wiley Post was an early aviation pioneer.
Next to Lindbergh, Wiley Post was America's ace flyer. Hero of two around-the-world flights, he'd had a share of...
He made two records of around-the-world trips in another plane, the Winnie May.
To blaze an after-gear trail to Moscow. They plan to return by Iceland to New York.
This is a different plane. It's been heavily modified. It's a little nose-heavy. But it shows Will standing on the wing, and there are children on a dock. And this the plane is on pontoons. It's in the water. And Wiley Post is with the children, and it looks like he's signing autographs.
Yes. Yeah.
So they're about ready to fly up to the northern point of Alaska, Point Barrow. And this is just before their takeoff. This photograph of Will Rogers with Wiley Post and the children, it's probably one of the last photographs ever taken of Will Rogers.
In this plane, two Americans famous the world over have crashed to their death. Wiley Post and Will Rogers, film star, journalist, wisecracker. Rogers set out from...
So tell us what happens on this flight.
They are about ready to take off and fly up a few hundred miles to Point Barrow, the most northern point in Alaska and on the North American continent. And the weather's bad. And at this point, Wiley Post is flying without radar or anything like that. It's all visual. And they have to land in a lagoon, and there are some natives there that they ask directions to. You know, where's Point Barrow?
Sort of get the local knowledge.
Right, to get their bearings. And as they were leaving, taking off, they got to about 50 feet high off the water when the engine stopped. And the plane just dropped like a rock.
And they both died?
They both died instantly.
In pictures, on the air, in journalism, Will has wisecracked his way into the big heart of America's millions and England's too. He was one of the great personalities of his age.
There were headlines in every newspaper across
Everyone
the country.
Everyone was completely shocked.
Will Rogers and Wiley Post are dead.
Wow, what a tragedy. So how old was he when he died?
He was 55 years old.
Wow, really young.
Yes.
So why, Jim, do you think that we don't know more about him? And he was so well known, as you said, in the pre-World War II. It's actually between the wars. And, you know, somebody who really helped Americans get through the Depression, why don't we know more about him now?
Part of that has to do with Will Rogers never had a platform like baseball that Babe Ruth had. In other words, it didn't come around every year. He didn't have that a platform like that. Will Rogers stood on his own.
There were no anniversaries, you mean?
There were no anniversaries. There were no records that Will Rogers set that could be broken like Babe Ruth.
Oh, interesting.
The
yes.
other thing is yeah. that Will Rogers never had, for instance, a product that was associated with his name. For instance, Walt Disney. I mean, everybody recognizes
right.
Disney.
Yes.
Or we mentioned Henry Ford, you know.
Got the cars.
The cars. You see him every day. So we remember Henry Ford.
And a number of the movies that he made were actually silent films, right? So
yes.
they're really outdated. We wouldn't even watch them unless you're an archivist or a historian.
50 silent films. 20,
50, wow.
21 talkies, if you will. And yes, they're a little bit dated. And Will Rogers, although when he died, he was Hollywood's foremost actor, popular actor, behind Shirley Temple. So, like Shirley Temple, there's no cocktail or drink that kids can,
right.
you know,
we don't have
consume.
The Will Rogers cookie or anything.
Right, there's nothing like that. But he is well remembered.
That's it for this episode. A huge thank you to Jim Barber. And remember, you can see the images we talked about on our website at npg.si.edu/podcasts. And also our thanks to Sony Music Entertainment, British Pathé, and the Will Rogers Memorial Museum. Our podcast team includes Ruth Morris, Justin O'Neill, Anne Conanan, Deborah Sism, Sophia Bodo, Samantha Musser, and Rebecca Casemeyer. Our theme music is by Joe Kai, and Tarek Fuda is our engineer. Until next time, I'm Kim Sayet.
And that brings to the end another Express Yourself. Don't forget the 20th Mount Sulpice Music Fest. It begins in about an hour on the 500 block of Main Street here in Bonedale. Remember, your mask and joyful social distancing is encouraged. Thank you for tuning in. Happy 4th of July. Now go out there and express yourself. It's your right.